and welcome to the 10th episode of BoagtheWorld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Boag, and it's really good to have you all back with us, and hopefully you will enjoy this podcast despite the fact that we don't have our pop star Marcus Lillington with us this week. If you haven't heard of Marcus before, then you must be new to the podcast and you're really missing out on something special. But he will return. He's only on holiday and will be back in a couple of weeks. Okay, so this week on BoagWorld.com, we are going to look at the subject of accessibility. Accessibility really is something that is at the heart of my design approach and is key to how I tackle building websites, yet it's not something I've talked about yet in these podcasts. So today I want to do a brief overview about web accessibility, why I think it's important, what web accessibility actually is, why you should bother doing it on your site, and how to make decisions about how accessible you actually make your site. But before we get into all of that, we first of all need to have a little recap on what we covered in last week's show. In last week's show, I discussed the idea that it isn't always appropriate to use web standards on your designs. Wow, did that get a response or what? I've never heard such, or got so much feedback over a single issue, and loads of people have written to me. Some people saying, wow, that was great, you've really taken the pressure off of me. Others accusing me of backpedaling horribly on what I've said in previous podcasts. And I just wanted to take a moment to clarify what it was I was getting at. And it's really an underlying principle that should apply to everything we do in web design, from how we build the site, whether we use web standards or not, to things like usability testing, to accessibility that we're going to cover this week. That at the end of the day, the people that commission the websites that you and me build, or if you run a website, you yourself, you don't have a website just for the pleasure of it. You don't do it as some altruistic thing to make the world feel better. People have websites to make money, or in whether that's directly or indirectly. There has to be a return on investment on everything we do. So if you're going to have fancy graphics on your website with lots of flash animation and cool stuff like that, you need to be able to justify that from a financial perspective. Those things take time to build and to develop, and you need to know that they're going to be worth it and you're going to get your money back from them. Equally, the same is true with usability testing. There's no point of testing your website unless you're going to get a return on investment, unless that usability testing is going to lead to a more usable site that encourages more people to purchase or to contact you or to do whatever your call to action is. What I was getting at is the same should also be true of web standards. Now, in 99% of the cases, it is true. If you build with web standards, the return on investment is there. The return on investment in the form of a more usable site, a more accessible site that more people can access, an easier site to maintain, all of those kinds of things that come out of web standards mean that it really does produce a healthy return on investment. But there are some situations where that is not the case. And last week I was bringing up in particular the issue of very small websites, you know, only a few hundred pounds worth of web work, just for an estate agent or a car dealership or something small like that, that isn't going to want to be redesigning their site every 5 minutes. They don't really care too much about how easy it is to maintain. They just want to keep the price down as low as possible. And what I was getting at is, in cases such as that, then you cannot guarantee that you're going to get a return on investment for doing web standards based design. Now, that's not saying that you shouldn't do any web standards on it, but some of the more tricky things, like building a tableless design that does, let's face it, take longer using web standards, may not be appropriate for those smaller sites. It may be more cost effective just to use one or two tables, not hundreds of nested tables, but one or two tables, just to shortcut the development process and to make it quicker to get that site live in the first place. So that was all I was saying. I'm not throwing out web standards completely. I'm just saying it is a tool like any other, and you need to find the right place for it. Okay, so hopefully that will put the subject to rest, although somehow I doubt it. But let's move on. So, just to say in news stuff that this is your last opportunity. It's the last week that the BoagWorld.com survey is going to be running on our website. It's your last chance to have a say about what goes into this podcast, what additional features that we start introducing on the BoagWorld.com website. So please, please take a few minutes just to pop along to BoagWorld.com and click on the red survey button icon thingy in the top right hand corner. Okay, so take a few minutes to take our online survey. It literally is only a couple of minutes and it's completely anonymous, so you should be fine in doing that. Okay, right, moving on. Accessibility, web accessibility. I cannot believe we're in week 10 and I haven't talked about accessibility yet. Now is the time. Right, web accessibility. Well, what is it when we talk about web accessibility? It's always useful to have a definition, because you'll find that even amongst accessibility experts, there's some disagreement about what accessibility truly is. One group of people say that accessibility is about meeting the needs of disabled people. People that have got either a cognitive, physical or visionary disability that prevents them from using a site. Other people say that it actually goes much further beyond that, and that accessibility is also about meeting the needs of people that are using different technologies, different devices, different hardware, that kind of thing. Well, for the sake of this discussion, I'm going to say that it is both disabled people and those with different technologies. There are some good arguments for saying that actually it should primarily be about disabled people, because it is often beyond their control. Their disability is beyond their control, while some people have control over what browser they choose to use, etc. But I'm not really going to get into the details of that argument here. What I am going to say is that web accessibility, for the sake of this discussion, covers both physical disabilities and also not having the latest technology and that kind of stuff. So when we talk about physical disabilities, what are we talking about? Well, basically it falls into three broad categories. The first is vision related impairments. So that can range from colour blindness. 1 in 20 men are colour blind. So it's a very common disability there, and one that doesn't have a huge effect but can really screw up your use of websites when you talk about clicking on the red link, for example. So right through to kind of completely blind users that have to use text-to-speech browsers in order to be able to access your site. And then there's a whole plethora of in-between. And almost those in-between people are the people that are harder to deal with. People that are just losing their vision because of old age and situations like that. So vision is one area. Physical impairments are another. People that have got motor skill problems, so they have trouble using a mouse or in some cases even a keyboard. And, you know, we're not. You might be sitting there thinking, oh, this is getting pretty extreme. You know, do we really have to cater for all of these different, you know, disabilities, people that, you know, I can't control a mouse, for crying out loud, or can't control a keyboard. But actually, if you think about it, that is a relatively large proportion of the population that have difficulty with keyboards and mice. And that's mainly because they have arthritis, which comes with old age. So, you know, it's not a real fringe area we're talking about. We're talking about people who are getting older, the over 50 age bracket, that have huge disposable income. So you can't just kind of dismiss these people at all. And you really do need to consider physical impairments as well. And then there are people that have got cognitive impairments. By that I mean things like dyslexia, where they have trouble reading. And this can be exacerbated by things like flashing icons on the screen or stuff that distracts them and makes text harder to read. There's a whole list of things. So there are those kind of real-world physical disabilities. But there is a lot beyond disability as well. There's people that are using different devices and trying to access your website via a mobile phone, for example, or via a PDA. And these really are the biggest growth areas. That mobile phones in particular are the fastest growing area of internet usage at the moment. And you really do need to start thinking about whether people will want to access your website using different devices. Then, of course, there's different browsers. Gone are the days where Microsoft dominates things and you can get away with just designing for Internet Explorer. Now we live in a world where you also need to design for things like Firefox. And even within browsers like IE, there are different versions that have different requirements, and you need to work around those as well. So you really need to move beyond that saying, you know, we only support IE 5.5 and above. You know, you need to be looking much broader than that. It also affects, when we talk about web accessibility, we're also talking about access for people with different types of hardware as well. So that can range from different screen resolutions where people's video cards only support 800 by 600 or they choose to run at 800 by 600. But we're also talking about people with different connectivity speeds as well. People that still have got dial-up connections in preference to broadband. These kinds of hardware problems or issues really need to be taken into account as well when you think about accessibility. There's also a bit of a bizarre one that isn't often talked about, which is different environments as well. And in particular, I'm thinking about people that access the internet via work. Often in situations like that, people don't have audio on their PCs. They can't play back audio on a website. So there are accessibility problems of them accessing some content there. Also, corporate environments block certain plugins. Even relatively common ones like Flash sometimes get blocked within corporate environments. So we need to think about that as well and make sure that there are alternative versions to various plugins that we might be using on our website. And finally, you need to think about people's different abilities. That some people just are not as confident with the internet as we are. I mean, I don't know about you, but have you ever sat your mother or father down in front of a PC, or your grandparents even better, and asked them to do something? Something really simple, like fill in a form. It's the most enlightening experience, and if you've never done it, I really recommend you take the time to do it. Because all the little things that you take so much for granted, because you use computers all the time, you discover that people don't know them. People don't understand them. Simple things like you can tab between fields on a form would never occur to many, many people. Do you know that one of the most common search terms in Google is actually a URL? So that people type in a website address into Google in preference to the address bar at the top of the page because they think that that's how you get to websites. Or if they find a link to a website they like on another website, they'll always go to that website first to go to the website that they like simply because they don't know they can type in the address bar. It's quite amazing how limited some people's knowledge is, and it's very easy to get kind of caught up in this web design world where you think everybody's computer literate, everybody knows how to use the internet. And it's really important to also think about people's ability levels and making sure that you ensure your site is accessible to them. Okay, so that's kind of what accessibility covers in a really broad sweeping statement that of the different kind of groups that it covers. But why should you be considering making your site accessible? Well, there are four reasons, really. And the first is a legal obligation, and that's the one that most people talk about. They talk about how you are legally obliged to ensure that your site is accessible. And you get a lot of web design companies that are selling off of the back of that now and saying, oh, you know, you're going to be sued if you don't make sure your site's accessible. Well, that kind of depends. It depends on where you live in the world. And some parts of the world it's true and some it's not. And a lot of places is very ambiguous. It's hard to know whether or not you are legally obliged to make your site accessible. Take, for example, the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is covered by the Disability Discrimination Act. And no point in the Disability Discrimination Act does it refer to making sites accessible. However, what it does do in the Act itself is it refers to making sure any service that you provide is accessible to the widest possible audience. In the associated documentation that comes with the Act, it does make one reference to a travel company selling flights online. And it uses that as an example of a situation or a service that needs to be made accessible. But really, nothing has been tested yet in the British courts as to, in regards to what is defined as a service and what is not. Or even, for that matter, what it means to be accessible. You know, how do you actually define accessibility? And those things are, you know, there are various test cases at the moment being brought in various countries to test this out. But in a lot of places, there's nothing hard and fast in regards to your legal obligations. Now, in some countries like America, that's different. There is more specific legislation in place, but I can't say I'm an expert on that. But I think it is fair to say that whatever country you live in, within the next couple of years, you're going to find that there is a legal obligation on you to make your site accessible. And even now, there is a big grey area over it, and you certainly wouldn't want to take the risk of exposing yourself to litigation. So there is a real legal obligation on people to make their sites accessible. But let's just kind of set that aside for a minute. I think there's also an ethical obligation to make your site accessible. And I don't think enough people talk about this, that it's just the right thing to do. You know, in the same way as it's the right thing to do to put in a ramp outside a restaurant so that people in wheelchairs can access the restaurant, so it's the right thing to do to make a site accessible. In fact, you could actually argue it's even more of the right thing to do it with a website than it is in a physical location, because it's so much easier to do it online, to make a site accessible, than it is, you know, to kind of rip up steps and put in ramps and concrete and all the rest of it. To build an accessible website isn't an enormous undertaking, and we do have an ethical obligation, both as designers and clients, to ensure that the websites we're involved in are accessible. So enough of kind of preaching, and let's go on to the kind of hard commercial truth of accessibility, because that's my third reason why you should make your site accessible. That there is a big commercial reason to ensuring your site is accessible. Not only is it good PR, not only does it reflect well on the company, but also you'll make more money if you make your site accessible. Let's just take the disabled audience for a minute. So that's people that are registered as disabled. So that doesn't include people that are colourblind or that they've got poor vision due to old age. We're talking about registered disabled people. In the United Kingdom alone, it's estimated by the Disability Rights Commission that they have a combined spending power of 50 billion per annum. And that's UK pounds, 50 billion UK pounds per annum. And if you know anything about Britain, we've got proper billions, not like the American billions that aren't anywhere near as valuable as ours. I'm not quite sure what the difference is, but I know that £1 billion is more than a billion, you know, it's more than a billion is in the US. So that's a hell of a lot of money, huge spending power, and that's just disabled people. Registered disabled. It doesn't include people that are getting old, it doesn't include people that are colourblind, and it doesn't include people that are using different devices or browsers or hardware or any of those other things we covered. Imagine if you opened a shop, and let's say you sold clothing in your shop, and let's say that somebody came up and they had had a load of clothes in their hands. And they came up to the till and they handed you the clothes, and they were ready with their money in their hand to pay you, and you took one look at them and said, "I'm sorry, but I'm not going to serve you because you've got ginger hair." And, you know, it's an absurd idea that you would exclude people for any reason. Everybody's money's good, we'll take anybody's money. You don't exclude people for stupid reasons. Well, take, for example, a really tiny situation. How many of you use JavaScript on your websites? And out of those, how many of you use JavaScript as a form of navigation? Okay. Well, something like 1 in 20 people that use your website won't have the ability to access it using JavaScript. JavaScript will be disabled or not available to them for one reason or another. So that means 1 in 20 people that were visiting our hypothetical clothes shop were being turned away. That's ridiculous. 1 in 20 people. Why would anybody do that? So building an accessible site has a huge commercial benefit as well. But there is one final reason, and it's a little reason, but it's one that I like, and it's one that resonates with a lot of our clients, which is that search engines are probably the best example of visually impaired users you can find. That, you know, a search engine, when it comes to your site, isn't impressed by the pretty graphics, doesn't care about your the layout of the pages or the font sizes or anything like that. All it cares about is the content. And so in a sense, a search engine is very much like a blind user. So as you design your site to be accessible, you're also making it more accessible to search engines, and this will ultimately help your search engine placement. Good accessibility produces good findability, that your site is easier to find. Alright, so let's say I've convinced you now. But even if I haven't convinced you about accessibility, there's some really good articles out there about more detailed reasons about accessibility and why you should go for it. And on the webpage associated with this podcast, I'll make sure there's a link to some particularly good ones that really help you put together a business case for accessibility. But anyway, enough of that. So let's say I've convinced you of accessibility. How exactly is accessibility measured? How do you know whether your site is accessible or not? How do you judge whether you know, you're doing it right already? Well, different countries have different standards. For example, in America, there's the Section 508 standard or legislation, which kind of covers the things that they have to comply with as far as accessibility is concerned. The rest of the world, not that I'm saying America likes to do its own thing, but the rest of the world seems to be going along the lines of adopting the WCAG guidelines, which is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, otherwise known as the WAI, the Web Accessibility Initiative, all of which is created and exist thanks to the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium. Flipping heck, what a mouthful that is. And that kind of sums up the problem with accessibility, is that it's so flipping confusing when you first face it, and it can be quite overwhelming to start getting into accessibility. But let's give you the kind of potted version. So the W3C, who I've mentioned before, the same people that have written a lot of the guidelines about how to build websites that are used in web accessibility. So the W3C are made up of all kinds of people, like representatives from Macromedia, Microsoft, all the big players within the web world. And they have produced a set of guidelines, web content accessibility guidelines. And these guidelines give you a basis on which to build. They're broken down into three levels. Priority 1, Priority 2, and Priority 3. Priority 1, they call guidelines that you must adhere to if you're going to say that your site is in any way accessible. Okay, so they're the baseline on which to build. Priority 2 is the level that they say you should conform to, and that it's good for most accessible sites to conform to at least Priority 2. And then Priority 3 is you can conform to these. If you're super enthusiastic, if you really want your site to be accessible to the widest audience, then you go for Priority 3. But there, I want to kind of say that the WAI guidelines, the Web Accessibility Guidelines, are not the be-all and end-all of the story. They're fallible, like any other set of guidelines. And you need to be careful not to get too kind of caught up in just ticking boxes and saying, yes, I am Priority 2 compliant. And I tell you what makes this kind of situation even worse in a lot of cases is automated checkers. Have you ever heard of Bobby, for example? Bobby is a really classic example of an automated accessibility checker, and you can run a web page through Bobby and it will tell you whether or not your page is priority 1, 2, or 3 compliant. Well, that's what you're kind of left with the impression it does, but it doesn't really. All an automated checker can do is check against very basic yes-no situations. So, for example, one of the guidelines says that all images should have an alt tag, providing alternative text that describes the image when the image doesn't load for some reason or another. Fine, no problem with that. And an automated checker can tell you whether there is an alt tag associated with the image or not. But what it won't tell you about that alt tag is whether that alt tag is actually really descriptive of the image, or if indeed there is anything in the alt tag at all. It might just have a tag but be empty. So automated checkers only go so far, and they don't deal at all with some of the more subjective decisions, like is there sufficient contrast between foreground and background? Can you read text on top of the background? It can't tell you things like that, and it doesn't check things like that. So automated checkers have got a place. They're a good starting point. Now, how many people first encounter accessibility? But if you are using automated checkers now, please, please, please don't use them as the Bible. They're not the be-all and end-all of things. They're a starting point. They point out some of the kind of most basic fundamental problems with your site. But they're only the beginning. And I would almost say that for the W3C guidelines as a whole, that they're the start of accessibility, not the end of them. But you've kind of got to have something to work with. And so that's as good a starting point, I suppose, as any. So how accessible does your site need to be? You know, there's these three levels, priority 1, priority 2, priority 3, and then on top of that I'm saying, well, that should be just a starting point, there are other things you do. Well, exactly how accessible does your site need to be? Well, I guess, you know, obviously there's certain legislation people have to conform with in some countries, but I think looking beyond those kind of basic boundaries, you probably need to sit down and look at your target audience. Who is it that's using your site? Or more to the point, who is it that you want to use your site? And ensure that you're catering for them. So let me give you an example. One of my clients used to be the National Trust, which is a big heritage organisation in the UK. And for one reason or another, they have recently launched a new site, and not with my company Headscape, but they went to another third party. And I was quite hopeful and excited about seeing this new site. And my hopes were that it was going to be really accessible and they were really going to move on from the very basic accessibility we introduced in the original version. In actual fact, I find that they've done nothing about accessibility at all. In fact, the site is less accessible than it used to be when we originally designed it. And that seems absurd to me. I mean, the National Trust average member is over 60. The majority of the people that view that website are probably going to have some form of arthritis or poor vision. So the fact that they've done nothing with accessibility means that they've totally and utterly ignored their target audience. Fair enough, if they had looked at their audience and gone, well, these people, generally speaking, don't require any specific extra help with accessibility. 99% of them use Internet Explorer on a Windows machine. We know that, you know, they don't have vision problems, etc., etc. Then you could argue, using the return on investment argument that I talked about earlier, you could argue, well, it's not worth us doing accessibility. The return on investment isn't going to be high enough. But for an organisation like National Trust, it's a no-brainer that their site should be made as accessible as possible. But of course, as with everything, you need to find a balance. So look at your target audience, ascertain whether or not they have got accessibility needs, and how great those needs are. Now, I'd argue actually that to make a site compliant to priority 1 level, which is the most basic level of accessibility, is so easy that really everybody should do it. You know, it really is so basic to get your site that accessible that even those little estate agent sites that I said perhaps get out of doing tableless design don't get out of doing accessibility, as far as I'm concerned, because it really is simple to get to the bottom basic level of accessibility. But you do need to find a balance. You do need to look at your accessibility and then compare that with other issues and work out where the balance is. Let me give you an example. Obviously, the way your site looks and functions is very important to a lot of people. Take, for example, my own website or Headscape's website. As many of you know, I've been redesigning the Headscape website for about 5 years now. No, not quite that long, but it feels like it's been forever. And one day it will get finished and go live. You never know. But one of the decisions that I had to make as I was doing that site is weighing up the fact that a big part of our income comes from accessibility consultancy, so therefore it's important that our site is accessible. But another substantial part of our income comes from our design capabilities and our front end interface stuff. So it's important that the site was both accessible, but it still looked great and it looked cool. And you come across some interesting guidelines in the W3C accessibility guidelines that do create conflicts between design and accessibility. For example, there is a guideline 3.4, I think, what a sad geek I am, that says that you should use relative values on your website instead of fixed and absolute values. So what that basically means is that your site has to be scalable. The text has to scale. The site itself has to scale to fit the browser. Now, after a lot of consideration, we decided that in order to get the design style we wanted, that we wouldn't conform with this particular guideline. So actually, we're not compliant to, I think it's AA compliancy, because we don't fulfill this particular guideline. But in other ways, we're much more accessible. So you do need to kind of consider each guideline on its merits and decide whether or not you want to conform. And not just kind of make blanket decisions that you're going to be priority 2 or priority 3 compliant. Just look at each of the things that will make your site more accessible and decide whether it's worth doing or not. Also, we wanted to use some flash on our site and multimedia and that kind of stuff. So we had to decide, is it worth the additional time to then do the non-flash versions to make it accessible? And our decision in that case was yes. So you have to compare accessibility against design and make design decisions when it comes to your accessibility. Also, there are some technical constraints as well that you need to set against accessibility. For example, there is no point of deciding you're going to make your site AAA compliant accessible if your content management system doesn't enforce accessibility, because the site might go live and will be AAA compliant when it goes live, but as soon as anybody makes a change on that site using the content management system, it's no longer going to be accessible. So there's a trade-off to make there about, you know, the technical constraints of your site and comparing that to accessibility and deciding how accessible you can get away with being when you've got limited technical, you know, you've got limitations from a technical standpoint. And then finally, the one that I've already touched on a couple of times in this podcast is the commercial balance. You need to decide whether you're going to have a return on investment or not from making your site accessible. So to sum up everything that I've just said, to sum it up, basically, web accessibility is about more than just catering to disabled people. It's about opening your site to the widest possible audience so that as many people can access it as possible. It's worth making your site accessible, not just because of the legal obligations, not just because of the ethical obligations, but because it's commercially a good thing to do. It will make you more money from your website if it is accessible, because more people will be able to access it. Not only that, it reflects well on your company and improves search engine rankings as well. A good yardstick for judging accessibility is the W3C guidelines. The WCAG, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. That's a great yardstick, but don't use it as the be-all and end-all. And for goodness sake, if you're using accessibility checkers, make sure you do manual checking as well. So that's about it. That kind of sums up accessibility in a 30-minute slot, and hopefully you found it useful. Hopefully it will get you thinking more about the subject and taking it a bit more seriously. A lot of people ignore accessibility. I know I did for a long time, just pretended that it wasn't really there. And once I'd gone and looked at the accessibility guidelines that existed, that put me off even more because they look really complicated. But I would encourage you to persevere. Accessibility is a really big growth area that a lot of people are considering these days, and you need to ensure that your site is accessible to the widest possible audience. So if you've got any thoughts on what I've just talked about, if you've got any ideas relating to accessibility, please pop along to boagworld.com/podcast. Go to episode 10, which is this podcast, and you can add your comments there on what you thought of today's podcast and what you think about the subject of accessibility generally. And as always, I'm always pleased to receive emails from people with their thoughts and ideas and questions. Send them to paul@boagworld.com. And finally, if you would like to submit an MP3 question, that would be all the better, because I like to get those on. We've had a pathetic total of one so far, which I'm very disappointed in. So, thanks for listening, and hopefully you got something out of it. And I'll speak to you next time. Bye.